Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Toyota's nightmare movie, Total Recall.
Get ready for a surprise!
With an exploding PR problem and a new recall for the Prius hybrid because of brake problems, the number one automaker suddenly has a global identity problem.
If I'm not me, who the hell am I?
Question from consumers. What did the secretive Toyota know, and when did they know it?
We hope you enjoyed the ride.
Toyota's decidedly bumpy ride. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, February 8th, and The Takeaway, quite literally, is probably in the mind of my next guest. Patty Bach joins us. She's a real estate agent with the Harry Norman Agency in Atlanta, Georgia. Patty Bach, you own a 2007 Toyota Camry, right?
Yes.
And it's been recalled, right?
Yes, it has.
And do you get the feeling that the company knows a lot more about all this recall business than consumers like you?
I'm not sure. I think that perhaps people may just decide that there's something wrong with their car, too, just because they're hearing so much. There's so much going on.
So much media sort of coverage and hysteria.
Well, yes, I think so. And some of the hysteria is just on the part of the people.
Now, does Toyota still have you as a customer at this point?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I don't think there's a thing wrong with my car.
All right. Patty Bach, the Toyota company, is certainly betting there are a lot more people out there like you. Patty Bach, real estate agent and Toyota owner from Atlanta, Georgia. That's really keeping those customers is the takeaway for Toyota this morning.
Absolutely. Let's get to the other headlines this morning. And the biggest one is, of course, from New Orleans. The Saints won their first ever Super Bowl last night. They beat the favorites, the Indianapolis Colts, 31-17. An emotional victory for the Saints. New Orleans, of course, still struggling to rebuild after the devastation of Hurricane Katrina. And this Saints fan in the city was overjoyed with the result.
This is a victory for New Orleans. This is a victory for the Gulf Coast region. Everybody who lost their homes in Katrina, the Saints have jailed all of us together.
Meanwhile, Saints quarterback Drew Brees was named MVP for the game. He said the win was hugely meaningful for New Orleans, but also the wider community.
What can I say? We played for so much more than just ourselves. We played for our city. We played for the entire Gulf Coast region. We played for all the entire Houdat Nation.
In other news, it was all systems go this morning for the Space Shuttle Endeavour.
Five, we have to go for ready to start. Two, one, zero. Booster ignition and liftoff of Shuttle Endeavour.
And Endeavour and his crew of six launched from Cape Canaveral before light this morning. It was one of the last shuttle program scheduled missions, probably the last pre-dawn mission. Endeavour is carrying two of the last components to complete the International Space Station, including a dome-shaped module. IMAX filmmakers, beware, give astronauts a panoramic view of space for the first time. Crews in Middletown, Connecticut have been spending the night going through debris at an unfinished power plant damaged by a huge explosion yesterday. Fire officials in Connecticut say at least five people died in the blast. Perhaps 12 people are injured. Terrorism has been ruled out in the investigation. Fire crews say it's still unclear whether anyone else is trapped in the rubble. Trains, planes, and buses are still trapped in place in Washington, D.C. as the cleanup continues after that mid-Atlantic blizzard. The nation's capital is pretty well shut down again today with schools closed. And it's mud in Southern California where they're digging out. Mudslides caused by heavy weekend rains have evacuated residents in the area north of Los Angeles. Some residents have been allowed back. And markets this morning, the S&P futures are down. The Dow futures are down after being up for a while this morning. And the Dow begins at 99.36. Actually, the Dow begins just above 10,000 this morning. So what did you take away from last night's Super Bowl?
You have to wonder at a certain point, they're going to run out of heritage acts. The only thing I'm thinking right now is it's hard for a band to galvanize a crowd as diverse and big as a Super Bowl audience. Maybe since the White Stripes Seven Nation Army is such a big stadium hit, the White Stripes would be a pretty good bet for a future Super Bowl.
How do you top The Who? Is that what you're thinking about? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Good morning, everyone. And we talked to that Toyota owner of a 2007 Camry there at the top of the hour. And you can hear in her voice a sense that she's sticking with the company. She's not worried. Her car has been recalled. Her Camry, one of the most popular models sold in America, is being recalled. But she's not going to worry about it. But here's Akio Toyoda, who's the CEO of Toyota, speaking in that celebrated apology that he gave at a news conference in Tokyo on Friday.
I'm trying to do this work as soon as possible and with cooperation of our employee and our supplier and the dealers.
So news over the weekend, the company announced it is going to recall its popular hybrid Prius model in Japan, and we're awaiting word as to whether that recall is going to be extended to the United States. Lots to talk about regarding Toyota. Here's Micheline Maynard. She covers the auto industry for our partner, The New York Times. She's author of The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream. Mickey, good morning.
Good morning, John.
So I don't believe I've talked with you since this whole Toyota thing exploded. I mean, it really is a head-scratcher and one that I couldn't imagine we would have been talking about a year ago, right?
I don't think so. You know, Toyota's had quality problems before, specifically in 2005, when they had this unexpected spike in recalls. And at that time, the then CEO of Toyota issued an apology and put a committee together to make sure that it never happened again. And here we are 5 years later, and the same thing is happening again. And we wrote a piece on in the Times that ran this weekend that kind of looks at this pattern of discovering things, fixing them in the factories, but then being a little slow to recall the cars out on the road.
Well, let's take a look at some of that. I mean, in many ways, you're writing a portrait of a corporate culture that seems, on the one hand, careful if you're talking to shareholders, mm-hmm. but secretive if you're talking to consumers. Give us some examples.
Well, we were looking at a situation with these sticking pedals. There have been 2.3 million cars recalled in the United States because the accelerator pedal might stick. And I want to stress that, as people have been saying, there are very few cars involved in this. Out of 2.3 million, you know, there have been a couple of dozen reports of accidents, although when you look at the NHTSA database, the number of complaints is starting to grow.
Right.
But they had discovered a similar problem in around December 2008. In Ireland, I believe it was. By August of 2009, they were already replacing the pedals. They were the same pedals that are installed on some of the cars that are recalled in the United States. And yet, Toyota officials said they didn't know of any incidents in the United States until October, which was already after they discovered it in Europe and fixed it in Europe. And it just makes you wonder, do people really communicate inside Toyota?
And, you know, the remarks that they did make were less than honest. They must have known. And the pedals all came from the same outsource, a factory in Elkhart, Indiana, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yeah, the company's based in Elkhart, Indiana. And honestly, the poor company, CTS, is getting blamed. And I think they would correctly say that, you know, we build what they ask us to build. They give us the idea and the outline, and we go ahead and build it. So essentially, there's, you know, one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing, or maybe they do, and they're hoping that it doesn't become a problem. I would hate to think that all the goodwill that Toyota has built up and all the good things that it's done, you know, for its workers and all that through the years would be wiped out by this whole situation.
Well, Mickey, listen to the voice of this woman. She's a Toyota Camry owner. Her car, Patty Bach's car, has been recalled. Here's this goodwill you were talking about.
I think that perhaps people may just decide that there's something wrong with their car, too, just because they're hearing so much. There's so much going on. And some of the hysteria is just on the part of the people.
So, Mickey Maynard, that's one consumer's view. It seems like Toyota can rely on her, but I'm wondering if other consumers might actually decide to, hey, you know what, maybe that thing that was going wrong with the car is a problem, and reporting is going to increase, and we're going to see more complaints.
Right, or people who noticed a little something in their cars and just, you know, wrote it down to road conditions or ice or something like that, or, gee, did that really happen?
Right.
It seemed kind of strange. Now they might go think back on it and file a complaint maybe with their dealer and with the federal government. But there can be kind of a hysteria about this thing, and, you know, people saying, oh, I'm afraid to drive the car. And somebody said to me, well, do you think anyone whose car has been recalled has been driving it since then? And I said, well, yeah, people have to get to work.
Right. You know, Toyota came into the U.S. market, you know, more than a generation ago. In that time, it has become the largest car maker in the world, surpassing its competitors, General Motors and Ford. Yet, I'm wondering, given the profit problems that Toyota's had over the last 18 months and this recall problem, have they learned some of the maybe negative lessons, wrong lessons about working in the U.S. market, betting on trucks, betting on high-profit big vehicles rather than focusing on what they did best?
My theory on this is not that it's the fault of anyone in the United States. I think the American executives correctly knew what this market was turning into, but everything at Toyota has to be cleared with executives in Japan, and the Japanese market is so much different than our market, and especially it's, you know, it's like General Motors used to be, where people at Toyota look around and they only see people from Toyota and they live in a Toyota world, and so they make decisions based on not the American market but on what they see in Japan and what they think will be best for the company worldwide. So I would almost argue they were a little slow to do a competitive pickup truck, and they missed that market by a couple of years.
But they did create the Japan bubble. Does remind you of the old GM bubble from years ago. Do you think that Detroit automakers are in a position to take advantage of this vis-a-vis Toyota?
Well, the one bright note for Toyota, if it's a bright note at all, is that this is happening in one of the worst car markets in 25 years. So it's very possible that there might be some hoopla for the next couple months, and then by spring, when sales pick up, it could overcome some of this. I don't think the Detroit companies are in much position to, you know, drive this home, because they have relationships with Toyota. They have business relationships with them.
Finally, is this a technology story at all? The complexity of vehicles is getting to the point where we can't track safety the way we used to before we go?
Well, I think we get a lot more complaints about safety, but I was reading about computers on cars, and we had an excellent article on it in the Times last week. There are literally dozens and dozens of functions controlled by the computer, and if there's something going on with the software, it can be very, very difficult to fix that.
Maybe that's our next story. We'll ask you back. Senior business correspondent for the New York Times, Micheline Maynard, author of The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream. Thanks, Mickey. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check on some other stories we're following.
Endeavour is on its way to the International Space Station. The shuttle and six astronauts rocketed into orbit early this morning on what's expected to be the last nighttime launch for the shuttle program. They're hauling a special observation deck for the space station. And in the southern part of the country, that is the sound of New Orleans fans celebrating their very first Super Bowl win. The Saints upset the Indianapolis Colts 31-17 last night in a good game, two well-matched teams. Saints quarterback Drew Brees was named the game's most valuable player. He says it's hugely meaningful for the community.
What can I say? We played for so much more than just ourselves. We played for our city. We played for the entire Gulf Coast region. We played for all the entire Houdat Nation.
In the latest on that fatal explosion in Middletown, Connecticut, fire marshals are investigating what caused yesterday's blast at a power station under construction. At least five people died. This man lost friends in the blast.
Close personal friends, some union brothers. It's horrible. They were working, they were tested, and I just heard there was a gas explosion. I'm getting all kinds of phone calls from union brothers, and it's horrible.
Terrorism has been ruled out in that Middletown disaster. The Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office's charges will be filed later today against Dr. Conrad Murray, Michael Jackson's physician. We'll have more on that story. And with more than 90% of the votes counted in Ukraine's presidential election, the candidate who favors closer ties with Russia has a solid lead. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Coming up, we asked you last week to come up with your own independent political party, and we're going to hear what you guys came up with in just a minute.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time to take some takeouts on the news, and we'll start with Todd Zwillick, our political correspondent in Washington. Todd, a weekend snowstorm meant that the federal government's closed down today. Schools are closed, but it also means that over the weekend, people were stuck at home, maybe with their TVs on, and they didn't miss Sarah Palin speaking at the Tea Party convention.
We need a commander-in-chief, not a professor of law standing at the lectern.
Todd, is Sarah Palin, she must be talking about the wars overseas.
Yeah, a big applause line. You hear the crowd erupt when she said that. A little bit of a coded message for the crowd at the Tea Party convention there. What she's talking about is the decision of the Obama administration to try some terror suspects in civilian courts, Article III courts, instead of treating them as prisoners of war or enemy combatants. This is a huge issue on the right, whether it's the Republican right or the independent Tea Party right that Sarah Palin is courting there. She knows this is a big issue for them.
Well, the White House, John Brennan actually came out over the weekend. He's the Deputy National Security Advisor, and he said, look, how come these things didn't bother you during the Bush administration? Here's what he had to say.
On Christmas night, I called a number of senior members of Congress. I explained to them that he was in FBI custody. None of those individuals raised any concerns with me at that point.
He's talking at Abdulmutallab, the suspect arrested on Christmas for an attempted bombing of a plane over Detroit. But again, John Brennan is basically saying that you guys are turning terrorism and national security into a political landmine.
Well, yeah, and not during the Bush administration, of course. This is the Christmas attack that took place just this past Christmas. But he is saying exactly what you just said, Celeste, and it's very, very interesting because John Brennan is saying, hey, Republicans, you guys were briefed. You knew that he was read Miranda rights and being treated as a civilian prisoner at that time. You didn't say anything. Does this sound familiar at all? Because back in the spring, when the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was criticizing Republicans for waterboarding and not telling anyone about it, they said, wait a second, Madam Speaker, you were briefed back in 2003. You didn't say anything. And then she said, well, I was briefed, but the CIA lied to me. This is the same exact scenario with the roles reversed. It's very interesting how Washington works in this way.
Okay, Todd's Willick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
So one of the most momentous showdowns in Wall Street history, and you may not know anything about it, but Louise Story, our finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, is writing about it. You actually call a showdown between AIG and Goldman Sachs over a lot of taxpayers' money, it turns out, as one of the biggest sort of behind-the-scenes, dramas in the whole financial meltdown. Explain.
That's right. So, you know, AIG was bailed out.
That's right.
You know they were bailed out because they were running out of cash, and so they needed a taxpayer bailout. But you might not fully understand why they needed mm-hmm. that money.
Well, they owed money to somebody, right?
To Goldman Sachs and other banks.
There we go.
But in addition to owing the money, they had already paid them billions of dollars. By the fall of 08, they already had paid out $30 billion to banks in these collateral calls. It's a technical word when you shift money over right. on assets that you've insured. And Goldman, for an entire year, had been at the forefront of demanding this money from AIG and also marking mortgage bonds kind of the lowest in the market. Now, that said, it was within Goldman's right to demand money if it really deserved the money. And the issue here is, was Goldman too aggressive or not? Were they right or not? Did they have motivations to push very hard for this money at a time that, you know, really the walls were just coming down on AIG?
Indeed. When did this showdown actually take place? Just remind us.
Yes, it started July 2007. That's when Goldman first put in this demand. And it really got bigger and bigger. And, these are two companies that had been really close since the 90s. And they had once considered merging. And this tore apart this cozy relationship between AIG, Goldman Sachs. You had the chief executives at both companies at a very high level hashing this out. Mm. And in the end, you know, Goldman was paid. Goldman has survived very strong. And AIG fell and needed all this taxpayer money.
And AIG stock is nearly worthless. And Goldman got paid 100 cents to the dollar. In almost all cases.
They got paid out all of it, and they got paid out all of it by the taxpayer in the end.
Indeed. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For our last takeout, we turn the mic over to you. On Friday, as libertarians and political independents met at the National Tea Party Convention in Nashville, we asked you what your new political party would look like if you could make one, and your answers ranged from very detailed platforms, actually, all the way down to sarcastic.
My friends and I, we've created a political party. We call it the Unawares Party. And like a scenario that you might find would be, you know, they'd ask us a question, and you'd lift your head up off the desk and say, huh, what was the question?
It was Charlie from Michigan. A lot of cynics from Michigan. Listen to Dan from West Bloomfield.
My new political party is the halftime or part-time party, since it appears that so many legislators have so much time to campaign. Legislation should be a part-time job. So I proposed on the platform to slash their salaries, and since they're part-time, they don't need vacation pay or free health care.
Okay, this is a very popular topic in Detroit. This is Walter from the Motor City.
I would have the American Non-Denominational Political Party. Currently, there's too much political paralysis in Washington and too much inactivity due to all this Republican versus Democratic thing. So my party would be for people who want to get together, work, and do something that's right for the country.
The non-party party, and he wasn't the only one, calling for sweeping goals to transcend political disputes and get something done.
The party that I would have would be the Transparency and Accountability Party, which would really push government leaders and politicians to be more transparent and accountable to its people, which is really what democracy is all about, and this is not occurring throughout the nation.
Other people dreamed of some crossover between the two parties that actually exist. Chris Orbach from Manhattan wrote to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. My party would be called the Libertarian Socialist Party. Fiscally conservative but socially liberal, defend both the rights of corporations and individuals. This would be something of a return to what pre-culture war republicanism used to be before the Bible-thumping anti-gay right-to-lifers hijacked it in a paranoid response to the late 60s counterculture.
Thank you, Chris, and for everyone who called in to 8778-MY-TAKE or posted their comments, as Chris did, on our website, thetakeaway.org. And you can see all the political parties our listeners want to create at thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, tough economic times mean states are slashing their budgets. Have some of them cut too deep? Coming up, states are in terrible trouble, financially anyway, and they're having to make some very deep cuts all across the board in order to hopefully make the budgets balance. But in some cases, they may have cut a little too far. We're going to talk about educational cuts in just a moment in Washington State. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. The Saints marched all over the Colts last night. 31-17 was the final score. The Saints were down 10-0 early in the game, but Saints quarterback Drew Brees says they never doubted themselves.
You just continue to believe that you're going to find a way to win. And sure enough, we trusted in one another. Offense got it going. Had some big possessions there in the second half.
Brees was the game's MVP. He completed 32 passes, tying the record for completions in a Super Bowl. Space Shuttle Endeavour is on its way to the International Space Station. This morning saw one of the last launches for the shuttle program. Only four more are scheduled. Among other things, the crew is delivering the largest window ever sent into space. It'll give the astronauts a better view.
360-degree view. Yes, indeed. Beautiful pictures from that. Connecticut fire officials say there may be people missing after an explosion at a Middletown, Connecticut power plant. Officials said earlier they believed everyone was accounted for, but rescue workers haven't been able to explore a particularly unstable section. At least five are dead, a dozen injured. Iran says it'll enrich uranium to higher levels. It says the fuel would be used to power a research reactor. World powers fear enrichment will lead the way to the production of nuclear weapons. And here in the United States, Toyota's quality control issues are apparently hurting the resale value of its used cars. Kelley Blue Book has dropped the value of recalled Toyotas by as much as 3%, and some dealers are refusing to accept the cars for trade. Taking a look at world markets now, Asian markets down a bit while European markets rebounded today. Back at home, markets are up. The Dow will begin at 10,012, the NASDAQ at 2,141, and the S&P 500 starts at 1,066. Futures are down at this point, and those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Maybe you've never heard the term funding cliff, but I guarantee your state senator knows it very well. Sometime in the next year, the extra federal funds that padded state budgets during the recession are going to run out. But tax revenues haven't rebounded yet. So state budgets are teetering on the edge of a cliff, you might say. In some cases, they're falling over. And lately, states have been making deep cuts in order to balance their budgets. But sometimes you can cut too deep. So deep that you're no longer providing the basic services that are guaranteed in the Constitution. That brings us to the state of Washington. A judge there found that the state was violating its constitution by not providing an ample education for all students. He's ordered the state legislature to fix it. Tom Ahern joins us now. He's the lead attorney in the case. Tom, what did the judge's ruling find?
Well, the judge's ruling is based on Washington's constitution, and each state has a different education provision in their constitution, and ours says it's the paramount duty of the state to make ample provision for the education of all children residing within our borders. And the judge, after a trial that lasted from August through almost the end of October, found that the state simply was not doing that. The amount of funding the state was providing was grossly insufficient.
Let's go down to Daniel Thatcher. He's the education finance specialist for the National Conference of State Legislatures. Daniel, we have heard of these kind of lawsuits for years now, decades now, but there are certainly a number of them pending, and people are saying they might actually be successful now. Why is that?
Well, that's right. There's about 9 cases pending across the country right now. The success, I'm not sure about. I think it's too early to tell what the success will be on these. There's 2 things at play here. There's traditional adequacy lawsuits, which is going on in Washington. And then there's other lawsuits, like there was one in Kansas, where they're actually challenging the funding of education because of the recession.
Well, a lot of people are talking about this funding cliff that I mentioned earlier. And Tom, let me ask you, people are saying that the funding cliff is the federal government funds, the extra funds, running out. State budgets have not recovered in terms of income coming in faster. And therefore, a lot of states are kind of teetering on the edge of not providing basic services like education, like policing and public safety. Tom?
I agree with what you're saying. I'm wondering what the question is. I'm sorry.
Well, the question is, at what point does a state's constitution require that they not cut the budget too far?
Well, and that's exactly what the issue is going to come to a head here on. And there are times when the Constitution says you have to stop, you know, underspending. And we see that, for example, in take something like prison suits, when folks sue saying there's cruel and unusual punishment because your prisons are too small and you have too many people stuffed into a cell. Eventually, the courts say, you know, enough is enough is enough. You have to actually comply with your Constitution. And at least in the state of Washington, the court has made it very clear that their number one duty is to fully fund education.
Well, maybe
everything else.
Maybe that's the issue, though. Daniel Thatcher, let me get a comment from you, and we'll go back to Tom on this maybe.
Sure.
If we have time. Is this an argument, all taken together, looking at all the states, and they're all in different predicaments, for a,
sure,
a complete rethinking of the strategy for funding education in the United States? It's been a state duty, property tax, then a lot of these lotteries have been funding education. But I'm wondering, especially if you see Barack Obama getting heavily into the mix with the stimulus program, that we're really looking at a federalized educational system in the United States 20 years from now.
Well, sure. They say never waste a crisis. And this could be a good time for states to rethink how they fund public education. Now, how they fund public education is different from how much they fund education. And while, yes, the federal role in education is going to increase, and we're looking at perhaps an increase of 16% of total education revenues will come from the federal government by the time the federal stimulus dollars run out. And that's a huge increase. Typically, we run 8 to 9% of all revenues for education. It runs in the 8 to 9%. So whether or not the federal government will continue this role after the stimulus, I don't know if we can say that quite yet.
This is kind of the classic rock and hard place situation, though. What were you saying there, Tom?
Well, I was just going to say, if I can jump in for a second, coming from the other Washington, I frankly don't want folks in Washington, D.C. governing the way my state's education system is run. Because one thing I learned very clearly, for example, in this lawsuit over the last 3 years we've been litigating this, is that people at the local level really do know how to do things best and really do know what their kids need, what their students need, how to make their schools work. So I although like most people, I'm sure I'd like to have money from wherever it comes from, I think it's a mistake to set education policy in the other Washington.
That's Tom Ahern, the lead attorney for the plaintiffs in this education funding lawsuit in Washington State. Daniel Thatcher of the National Conference of State Legislatures. We've been seeing state budget cuts on not just education, but on things, as I was saying, but police, roads, and in a certain extent, the states are stuck. They don't have a lot of money. But I'm wondering if there are other areas in which perhaps they're vulnerable to constitutional challenges.
Are you asking me? This is Dan.
Yes.
Well, there's 3 things really at play here. There is a decline in state revenues like we have not seen for a long time. There's a drying up of the stimulus funds, which after fiscal year 11, 12 will no longer be around. And one thing that we've had in the past recession is that local governments were able to step up and help fund education through levying higher property taxes. But this time around, with the deflated housing values, which lead to decreased valuations of homes, which in turn lead to lower property tax revenues, that's fun. The local governments aren't going to be able to step up like they have in the past. So that's adding to this cliff. And whether or not state courts will look at how much a state is funding education in this whole context and say, you have to spend at this level, even though there's no revenues, either from the local governments, state governments, or federal governments. Again, I don't know how willing courts are going to be to say to states, you have to fund this education at this level, even though revenues aren't there.
Yeah, that would kind of be a judge's ruling for an unfunded mandate, I guess. That's Daniel Thatcher, education finance specialist for the National Conference of State Legislators. Thanks to both of you. Coming up, we're going to talk about the history of Black History Month and some people debating its future. It's in a moment. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And here's why I love New Orleans, Celeste. Anywhere else in the world, if you're partying and the sun comes up, you kind of go, oh, I've been up all night.
In New Orleans,
you go, the sun came up, I'm still partying. And your point is? And that's what they're doing in New Orleans. The Saints defeated the Indianapolis Colts yesterday in the Super Bowl, 31-17. Bright news for a place that has a habit culturally of turning bad news into great news and to joy. Jason Isaac joins us. He's a WNYC engineer and producer, one-time New Orleans resident who finds himself in New Orleans this morning. Jason, good morning.
Good morning. I don't know what happened. I thought I got on a plane to Indianapolis, and the next thing I knew, I was in the quarter.
Oh, boy. But, who are you going to pay for that mistake? You got to thank them.
Oh, yeah, you're right, John.
Describe the scene.
Great day to be in New Orleans.
Describe the scene.
Well, I was watching a game uptown last night, and at a bar, you know, neighborhood bar, long-time gathering spot for Saints fans, and it was absolutely raucous. The entire game, second half especially, starting with the onside kick to start the second half, the place just went crazy and then never settled down. By the time there was about a minute left in the game, people were standing on the bar. I saw a few men taking their shirts off, I guess for good luck or something.
For good luck, yeah, and of course. It's for good luck, Jason. That's what they tell you down there in New Orleans. Hold on for one second. Jim Spalding, manager of the Avenue Pub down there in New Orleans. How many rounds were ordered just after that onside kick at the beginning of the second half, which really changed the momentum in favor of the Saints?
Wow, you can't count them. Too many to count.
So, you know, I don't want to count how much business you did last night, but are you still open, Jim?
Yeah, of course.
And how many people would you say are in the bar right now?
Maybe 90.
90?
Probably 80.
How have you managed to keep your voice?
I don't have a voice.
There we go. It's Jim Spalding, manager of the Avenue Pub in New Orleans. How much does this mean to the residents of New Orleans? And then we'll ask Jason before we go. Jim?
I've been here since 02.
And it means a lot. If you have to think about it that much, I suppose.
This was destiny, first off, to begin with. You know, Katrina could have been the greatest catastrophe to ever happen. This was probably the greatest uncatastrophe.
Yeah, Jason Isaac, can you hear that? The coining of words, the fumbling for emotional descriptions. Take me there.
Well, listen, for 43 years, the city has had the absolute worst luck as far as football goes. And for a lot of that time, there's also been a steady drumbeat of bad news with Louisiana ranking near the bottom in terms of education, economy, health care, things like that among the 50 states. And for one night, New Orleans is number one, undisputed champions, and it means a whole lot to everyone here, without a doubt.
Indeed, and it's certainly going to give an extra joy to the Mardi Gras celebrations, which begin in less than a week. Jason Isaac, WNYC engineer and producer, one-time New Orleans resident, and Jim Spalding holding the fort down there at the Avenue Pub in New Orleans. Thanks and congratulations to both of you.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. So if Black History Month has its roots in the 1920s. How come we still need it now if it was expected to be a temporary solution to an imbalance in our history textbooks? We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. As we've been talking about all morning, New Orleans celebrating after the Saints beat the Colts 31-17 in the Super Bowl last night. Damon Marbut, a restaurant manager in New Orleans, says it's a crazy and wonderful atmosphere.
The entire city is blown up. And I think my restaurant's destroyed. It's going to take my entire staff a good 2 hours to try to put it back together. It's absolutely wonderful.
Parades are being prepared in the Big Easy just days before Mardi Gras gets underway.
Lots of snow shoveling to do in the nation's capital today. Tens of thousands of workers in the snowy Mid-Atlantic region have been given the day off. The Superstorm storm buried some areas in nearly 3 feet of snow, and it's not over yet. 5 more inches are expected. In Middletown, Connecticut, fire marshals are investigating what caused yesterday's blast at a power station under construction. At least 5 people died, and dozens were injured. And now, according to early results, Costa Rica has elected its first ever woman president, Laura Chinchilla. Her rivals have conceded victory and congratulated Ms. Chinchilla, who's expected to continue the policies of former President Nobel Peace Prize winner Oscar Arias. Vladimir Hernandez of the BBC Spanish service has been following the story, joins us from Bush House in London. Vladimir Hernandez, good morning.
Hello, good morning to you.
So Costa Rica is a hugely influential nation in the region. How does this election, do you think, ripple throughout Central America and even deliver messages south?
Well, I mean, the fact that it's continuity in Costa Rica, as you've well said, that the country is always offering itself in negotiations, trying to bridge people together within the region, sort of maybe extreme postures on one side and the others, like recently happened in Honduras. Costa Rica was a main player in that situation, that crisis. And what appears to be is that this will continue as she is continuing the government of Oscar Arias, a well-respected figure in the whole region.
Can you give us a few facts about her as a politician and her background, Laura Chinchilla?
Yeah, she is a political scientist. She used to be the vice president of the country. And the key issue here maybe is that she used to be the person in charge of security in Costa Rica. And this is one of the main concerns of the population right now, because as we all know, there is a high security alert in terms of drug-related violence in Central America and in Mexico particularly. So what she is expected to do in this case is quite significant, especially considering that Costa Rica doesn't have an army since about 50 years or so.
All right. Remember the name Laura Chinchilla won comfortably, the first president of Costa Rica. That report from Vladimir Hernandez, the BBC's Spanish service in London. Thanks so much.
It began in 1926 as Negro History Week. February was picked because it contains the birthdays of both Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. In 1976, it became Black History Month. And the goal, I'm going to quote directly here from the United States Department of State, is that one day the sharing and contribution of all Americans in America will be so appreciated, accepted, and understood that there will be no further need for any ethnic group to call attention to its contributions and exploits for the good of the country. Joining us now to talk about this is a William Payne, former assemblyman in the New Jersey State Legislature, author of a bill called the Amistad Law that enacted this type of education policy in New Jersey. And Raina Kelly's a staff writer for Newsweek magazine. She recently wrote an article on why she thinks we still need to keep Black History Month. Raina, let me start with you, because you went into this article expecting to talk about how you thought we shouldn't have Black History Month, and then you changed your mind.
That's exactly what happened. I was doing research on an essay that was going to be called The End of Black History Month. I think like a lot of people, a lot of African Americans, I found the month ghettoizing and patronizing. Why should our history be reduced to 1 month and, of course, the shortest month of the year?
Right.
And when I started doing research, I realized there was just so much I personally didn't understand about African American history, that what happened was I became disappointed with the way we've been celebrating Black History Month, not Black History Month. And I realize there's still a lot of work to do, there's still a lot of issues that we could bring to light.
But, you know, but by continuing Black History Month, you might say that it allows us to be complacent about the inequality in our textbooks. In other words, we all teach about Thomas Edison, but the guy who invented the filament that goes inside the light bulb was an African American, and that's not something that we have to learn about in February. And that brings us to Bill Payne. Bill, you actually were outraged by by the inequality in the textbooks and in the history curriculum, and you set out in the 1990s to try and make it an everyday lesson, right, in New Jersey schools, and that led you to write this Amistad Law.
Absolutely, yes. It was my feeling that contributions of African Americans to the development of this country, in fact, to the Western Hemisphere, should be taught to all students and throughout the year and in its proper chronology. For instance, I'm talking about the development of this country, for instance, when we had the Revolutionary War. We always taught about the Redcoats. Pardon me. We taught about those who fought on our side, etc. But never do we teach in the general history about the role that African Americans played in the Revolutionary War. So many African American youngsters and white youngsters, for that matter, grow up with this sense that blacks simply did not exist, or if they were there, they were on the sidelines. And so, therefore, young African-American youngsters growing up in this country don't see themselves in the textbooks, even throughout the Civil War, where we fought as well, but not taught that. So we grow up with a sense of low self-esteem, don't identify with the brave people in this country, because everything about African-Americans is always negative, and that is during slavery, we talk about pickaninnies, and then after that, they talk about old Black Joe, but never do we talk about the positive things. So what Amistad does, it has U.S. history. We don't talk about black history. We talk about the history of this country, and you simply cannot teach the history of this country if you leave out omit the role that African-Americans play, because in that sense, you're teaching lies, you're teaching myths, etc. So Amistad says you have to reconceptualize the teaching of history and social studies in this country, take it apart, put it back together again, and infuse the role that African Americans played throughout our history.
And black you actually offer a free resources online for teachers. I want you both to listen to this clip from actor Morgan Freeman. This is back in 2005, and Raina's nodding her head. I'm sure she remembers this very well. This is Morgan Freeman on CBS's 60 Minutes.
I don't want a Black History Month. Black history is American history.
How are we going to get rid of racism?
Stop talking about it. I'm going to stop calling you a white man.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask you to stop calling me a black man. I know you as Mike Wallace. You know me as Morgan Freeman. You're going to say, well, I know this white guy named Mike Wallace. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
Raina, I mean, you're very familiar with that. I'm very familiar with that. And it echoes this frustration that here was this temporary solution, which is what Black History Month was meant to be. And some people feel that because we still have Black History Month, it excuses people from not fixing the core problem of integrating the histories together.
I mean, I think that we both need Black History Month, and we need to recognize that Black History Month can make us complacent. I think I was talking to Annette Gordon-Reed, a historian who's done a lot of groundbreaking work on Thomas Jefferson, and she said, you know, Black history is American history. However, Black History Month is a time for a special appreciation. In a school curriculum right now, kids only go to school 180 days a year. There is not going to be time to pinpoint various issues like, you know,
well, there's huge dramas that remain to be told. You refer to the Hemingses, the Jefferson story. There's the slave revolt in 1712 in New York City, which was a huge event that nobody ever learns about.
You know, today is the 40th anniversary of the Orangeburg massacres in Mississippi. I mean, there are lots of stuff. There's lots of stuff that just can't be covered in a school year, but that we can draw special attention to in February.
Bill Payne, what do you think about that? There's not enough time in the rest of the year to call attention not just to African Americans, but to all minority contribution.
But I think we missed the point if we keep talking about black history. I think what we're talking about is the history of the United States of America, U.S. history, and therefore which should be infused there, you see. Any kind, and I don't say let's get rid of black history studies, but they're electives around the country. White children as well as African-American children must learn that a black man invented the traffic light or the gas mask and things like that. So each group will have a feeling of self-esteem and say that I can do that as well. If we relegate it to Black History Week or Black History Month, you can rest assured that most schools throughout this country will not give serious attention to that. But if it's fact as part of the curriculum of U.S. history, every single school in the United States of America, regardless of whether there's any black students or not, will have to teach this and will teach this. And those youngsters will benefit from it, the white youngsters as well as the black youngsters.
Bill Payne is a former assemblyman in the New Jersey State Legislature, author of the New Jersey Amistad Law, and Raina Kelly is the staff writer for Newsweek magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A lot of African-American history bound up in the Super Bowl win by the New Orleans Saints last night. Go to our website and find out who's giving their own takeaways about the game, thetakeaway.org, or you can leave your reaction at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.